It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Can it be? Yes, it is. Less than a week since the big fight between Apple and the Department of Justice. Andy and Renee are here. We're really going to break this down. Now, there's been time to think about it. I think we've all come to some conclusions, some of which may surprise you. We'll also talk about loud noises coming from that Apple plant in Sunnyvale. What could that mean? And Tim Cook's interview with Adam Leshinsky at Fortune. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey. This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 495, recorded Tuesday, February 23rd, 2016. Come for the ham, stay for the handset. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by LegalZoom. Get your life organized today with an estate plan bundle at LegalZoom.com. Whether you need a will or a trust, since they're not a law firm, work with an independent attorney available in most states to find a plan that best fits your needs. Enter MBW in the referral box at checkout. That's LegalZoom.com. And by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Macintosh news. The Core Group is with us today. Andy Iannacco from the Chicago Sun-Times. Love having you on.
I want to quote a line from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
So, what shall we talk about?
I wonder, is there any news? Renee Ritchie's here from iMore.com. I had to ask these guys because
I'm ready, Leo.
You ready? What do you got?
I'm ready.
There it is.
Got my protest.
Is that the hashtag? Stand with Apple?
And I used glitter. I used the word sparkles before, and Megan yelled at me. So
you actually made a sign that says hashtag stand with Apple?
I tried to, and then Georgia took it away from me and made a proper sign. So I got this ready. They're doing rallies today at 5:30 Eastern at local Apple stores. So I'm ready.
Interesting. You know that at least here in the United States, almost 60% of Americans agree with the FBI.
We haven't told the story properly yet, Leo. That's all that means.
So
we haven't explained it to them.
In a way, we have an advantage that we didn't. This happened the day after we did Mac Break Weekly last week. And I find that hard to believe because I feel like I've talked it to death because we'd spent a lot of time on Twig talking about it and then again on This Week in Tech. But it is, after all, an Apple story, so we're going to talk about a Mac Break Weekly. And in a way, we have the benefit of a week later because this story has changed. Andy, you said you had written one story and then you didn't file it because it changed so fast.
Yeah, as more data came in, as the nature of the request, the reasons why the mechanism by which they were making that request, Apple's response to it and how they were choosing to respond to it. And this was definitely one of those situations in which the more of Apple's story you hear, the more this story changes. Also, the more you talk about how this request has been made, that also changes things. It's not, I don't think it's a question of black and white. White hat versus black hat, but it's definitely an argument that has been a long time coming. And boy, this is Frazier versus Ali.
In this case, Frazier has the manpower of the United States federal government behind it. Ali,
Apple is slightly better budgeted than even the FBI. I
mean, so it's the Department of Justice working on behalf of the FBI, its branch. But let's talk about really what now – I think one thing that probably the polls don't take into account is what's really going on here. And in fact, it may be that Americans understand it better than technophiles because it's not – the story is not about encryption per se. The story is about the FBI asking Apple to make changes to
one iPhone's firmware in such a way that that iPhone can be brute forced. Because everybody knows you can't crack the encryption in iOS 8 and iOS 9. It's strong encryption that is not crackable. But there is kind of a weakness, which is if you can guess the passcode, that will
use a weak passcode.
The passcode's weak. Apple has put some protections in place, as we all know. It's a 5-second delay between passcode entries. And in some cases, if you turn this on, after 10 tries, the phone gets erased. The FBI doesn't know whether that's the case. So what they would like Apple to do, what the court order says Apple must do, and we should hear Apple's response in the next 3 days, is three things. One, modify the firmware of the phone so that the 5-second delay is gone and it eliminates any chance of erasure after 10 failed attempts, because the FBI might have to go through all 10,000 codes to unlock it. And finally, three, they want a way to do this without using some poor intern's fingers. They want to do it through Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. The key on this is, again, not that Apple would have to put a backdoor in its encryption. That is not what they're asking. However, the question is, and this is probably the argument Apple's going to make, is it too much to ask Apple to create new firmware, and by the way, sign it with Apple's magic key, because firmware will not run on an iPhone unless it's signed by the Apple key, which is kept, I'm sure, under lock and guard at Apple headquarters. So they'll have to write new firmware. I don't know how challenging that is, but I suspect somewhat. They'll have to sign it, and then they'll have to put it on that phone. They have to connect it. How do they put it on the phone, Renee? They connect it via iTunes? Could they do it over Wi-Fi?
Well, they have something called Purple Restore at Apple, which is the way that they put betas and other it comes from the project
that doesn't
Purple,
wipe
which is
the
code name for the iPhone. That's unknown. I mean, a traditional restoration of firmware does replace the firmware on the device, but given that Apple owns the entire thing, it's conceivable that they would have ways of doing that.
So Apple says, yeah, we can do it, but it's something we think is too dangerous to do, because the only way to guarantee that this new firmware isn't abused and doesn't fall into the wrong hands is to never create it. I would say, if you say, well, look, it's the FBI, Apple keeps its key safe enough. I imagine the FBI could be, you know, trusted to keep this firmware safe enough. And by the way, the firmware can be tied to the unique device identifier, right?
Yeah, I believe their response was more precedent setting, that if the FBI can ask this once, they can ask this every time, and then the Chinese government can ask this, and then governments that are at war with their citizens could ask this. And the size of the market in China and in many other countries is increasingly big and might overpass the US. So this is entirely a battle over precedent, not really about this one iPhone.
And then we should also point out that Apple's not saying no. In fact, Apple hasn't responded yet. They have a few days to respond. But it's not that they're saying no. They're asking the court not to make them do it. They're asking the court to say, you know, and the court order said if it's, you know, Apple could show it's sufficiently burdensome.
Which is that old law, right? It's a 200-year-old writ that they're using to affect it. Yeah, the All Writs Act, yes. Which has to pass, I believe, three prongs of reasonability.
Yeah.
And that in itself is interesting, because I was talking to some people who are familiar with this law and work. I can't name them, but people who are justly very familiar with this, and they all kind of refer to it as the "sure, why not? Let's give that a try" act. Right. In that it's very, very broad. It really is. It was written when they were trying to lay out the entire judicial system about who gets to make the laws, Congress or the judiciary, and it was sort of a necessary backdoor that said, well, what happens if Congress has not passed a law for or against anything? If there's absolutely no guidance, can the court simply say, until Congress says otherwise, we're saying you can do this or you can't do this?
It authorizes federal courts to issue all writs, which would be court orders, necessary or appropriate in aid of their respective jurisdictions and agreeable to the usages and principles of law. It really, as vague as that sounds, it's exactly as you say, Andy. It's saying, well, the courts, if it's not spelled out in the law, the courts can issue court order for something that they want to have happen.
Yeah. So this is why there's a lot of wiggle room in this whole case. It's because there have been other precedents where they have said, well, because, for instance, there's a difference between compelling. Let's say that I've got my phone here and I'm involved in some sort of a legal action. This phone is protected via a password and via a fingerprint. And the court can't, if I don't want to give them the password, I can basically claim that I don't have to give you that password because this has evidence that might incriminate me. And so the information that I have the ability to decide not to give you. However, with a different application, they have decided that, well, you don't have your fingerprints are just your fingerprints. You don't have the ability to decide not to have them. So we can't, or rather, it's easier for the court to order you to provide your fingerprint because, again, you do not have the ability to decide not to have this fingerprint on your finger. Right. So this is why the law is hysterically funny. It also becomes a problem because let's say this all goes through as the FBI wants, they also have to have Do they have the ability to decide to define for themselves what consists of Apple conforming to this court order? So let's say that Apple does give them this ability to bypass the passcode on this one device, but they can't find the information that they wanted. Do they then have the ability to say, well, pursuant to given that we made this request because there might be information that can save American citizens' lives on this phone, we're now going to ask you to please disassemble this part of memory that's in a secure part that we can't read. There need to be a lot of specifics about this hashed out before we really know exactly how big and broad this is.
So why, I mean, given that it would be, I think the argument that it's going to leak out that Apple's using, I don't think that's a strong argument.
It's a principled one. I mean, there are a lot of things about Apple's actions that are 100%. To an outside observer, because again, we haven't heard these sort of open and in-depth conversations with Apple about this yet. There are a lot of things that are really altruistic that they could make their lives easier by simply complying with this. But then there's a lot of this where this is just really good. It is definitely in their best interest to not create this tool. What is not appreciated by, I think, the 60% of the people who think that Apple should comply with this is that this is not a small thing. It's not as though they have to go to a locked file cabinet inside Cupertino, pull out a passcode and hand it to the FBI. If that were within their capability, Apple has already worked with the FBI on this case to a really intense level. I think the line in that public letter employee email that Tim Cook posted was very, very carefully chosen, that we hate terrorists. We don't want terrorists. We are helping the FBI. We've helped them step by step by step. The thing is, we don't want to write a new version or a hack to our own operating system. What they don't understand is that there's going to be a huge amount of work to do this. So they're basically asking Apple to create a brand new product. That's pretty much what they're asking to do. Not only that, but this is where day three of my working on this turned into day four and day five, because now we're into a whole new kettle of fish. If Apple is now creating a brand new piece of software for pulling this data or for allowing access to this phone, it's possible that this data, this procedure is going to have to be documented and tested and proven outside of Apple so that it can be proven that, no, the FBI didn't just put information on this phone. Let's say that the FBI gets a list of contacts of whether this imaginary person is guilty or innocent, a person that these people had been in contact with four times just before the tragedy. And now they're going to charge this person with a crime because they lent this person $100 for bus fare because their transmission was shot or whatever. That the defense attorney for that defendant is going to have the ability to say, okay, well, how do we know that they got this data fair and square? How do they know this data was even on the phone in the first place? And so basically Apple could be hypothetically required to have built this tool in such a way that it has been observed every step of the way, documented every step of the way, so that it can be challenged every step of the way.
This is Jonathan Zdarsky's. And by the way, if you haven't read his blog post, this is his point in his blog post. He's a forensics expert besides being an Apple security expert.
Literally wrote the book on iPhone forensics.
Yeah. And that's his point, is that now Apple's suddenly a forensics company. It's a bit, and that may be burdensome.
Which is worse because a forensics company is allowed to test things, and the rules for allowed to test things are very different from a company that makes a forensic tool that is used by law enforcement. Yeah. And that's where all the disclosure and declaration and peer review and everything comes in.
And I think we could agree that Apple shouldn't be in the forensics business. That's kind of not good for its business.
And the only way around this, or excuse me, the way it's been explained to me that one way around this would be for the FBI to have someone, for lack of a better word, embedded at Apple that they can be a witness and they can testify about
chain
about
of command and all that. Yeah, chain of
but now we have
that.
A very getting very close to Godwinning this conversation. But now we have a situation where do you really want to have a political representative of the government embedded inside various companies to observe what's going on? That's another one of those. There are a lot of things that we don't like about this in principle, and that would be another one of them, though that is hypothetical. But we're trying – it all comes to the point of it's just really, really difficult for Apple to do this and not create immense trouble for them way down the road, which is why, although I think that I don't think the FBI is doing something wrong by making this demand, I also don't think that Apple is doing something wrong by saying we refuse to do this until it is proven that we are required to do that. And that's exactly what the court system is there for. I'm sure this is going to go as high up as it can possibly go before Apple complies or the FBI gives up.
And I think that's completely appropriate.
Exactly.
As you say. I mean, and I think that, you know, what Tim Cook said was not Apple's response to the court. What Tim Cook did when he published his open letter on Apple.com is raise these issues and say there should be a public discussion of this. But Apple has not yet responded to the court. And so we don't know what Apple's going to say to the court. We expect they'll say something like this is, you know, the tests you mentioned, the three-factor test for applicable application of the All Writs Act, the party ordered cannot be too far removed from the case. In this case, I don't think you can argue that Apple's removed from the case. It's an Apple iPhone. The government, and this is, I think, the one that's going to end up being the key one. The government's request cannot impose an undue burden on that party, and the party's assistance is necessary. I think one and three are satisfied. There's, but this is the only way, in other words, Apple can argue, I'm no attorney, is that it's an undue burden on Apple. Not that it would be, this larger discussion about security and so forth. I mean, that's not really how they can defend. They can't. Maybe they can go to the court and say that's part of the burden is, well, now you're going to make, you know, you're going to impinge on security for everybody. But let me ask you guys this question. If Apple is complies or is forced to comply, does it really, it's not like it's a golden backdoor to encryption. It's not that. How does this hurt us and hurt our security?
So, I mean, there's a couple of things that are really interesting about this, and following the case day to day and watching how it's changed has been very informative on it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, originally, why would Apple put out this statement? And it was because it looked like this was going to be not a quiet backroom dealing, which Apple has been involved in many times.
And Apple asked for.
Absolutely, absolutely in this case, but that this was going to be put in front of the public and that it was strategically chosen because it has a lot of hot button issues like terrorism to put Apple in as worse a light as possible, the least sympathy that could be made for Apple as possible. And this is something law enforcement, it's been going on for over a year, for several years actually, but over a year just in the papers alone. And that's this push by some in law enforcement and some in government to actively remove or reduce encryption or to introduce backdoors. Although this is not a specific backdoor, to introduce the ideas of backdoors in general. This is a huge war that's being fought within law enforcement, within the government. Not everyone in the government agrees or is on the same page, but it is a huge debate. And this case seemed almost cherry-picked. And it looked like the famous quote, in an emotional versus a rational argument, the emotional argument wins. And when you see the way the FBI has been talking about this, including the FBI director, it really does make people think that Apple is, you know, on the wrong side of this. They're not standing up. That they're basically with terrorists and against freedom. And I think Apple's response to this and making it public has been part of that, part of sort of fighting back on the PR front and saying that we absolutely believe in freedom. And these are the reasons why we think this is a bad idea, including foreign powers doing the exact same thing as the FBI. And I think that is a couple of the big concerns here are this will allow effectively the government to force Apple to write software, to write what is to either lessen their security or to write software specifically designed to retrieve data, a forensic tool to retrieve data from iPhones. And it's unclear whether the government can or should be allowed to force companies to write that kind of software or to do that sort of thing to customer data. But also it opens the door to, like, the FBI was very careful to say this is a one-off, but it's now been revealed that they have, you know, that the various legal departments have 20 plus more phones, hundreds of more phones that if this works,
Apple has been presented by the FBI with 20 more phones, most of them not terrorist cases, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. And again, terrorist is a super emotional issue.
Right.
And then it's been the New York Times had a great article saying China was thinking of doing this last year, and it was only America's hesitancy to impose similar laws that held them back. But the minute this goes through in the U.S., China is right behind. And if China orders Apple to give a similar tool, whether it's for use against criminals or dissidents, because every country has its own measure of what criminal activity is, Apple, how could Apple say no to China if they said no to the United States or Russia or to a government who's literally at war with their citizens? It's a very slippery slope. It's an internationally very slippery slope. And it's something I think, you know, we talk about this all the time, but I think it's something that lay people, when presented the way the FBI presented it, would think that Apple was not on the right side of it.
Yeah. And that's, well, there are two sides to that, of course. One of them is that it's sort of like an evergreen legislative bill to force phone makers and hardware makers to make sure their backdoors and everything. That's been true basically for the past 10 or 15 years since I've been paying a lot of attention to that sort of stuff. And of course, in the light of all this, you're seeing some really silly legislation that might force Apple to create new backdoors to every phone sold in California or $2,500 yep. Fine per infraction. But there's also a difficulty where if there were an easy way for the American government to get through encryption that had been placed on a device by an American company, that makes it super hard for that American company then to sell that same hardware internationally to other governments, because they're going to know that you're basically giving access to that there is a tool that the American government has to access all of their communications. The other thing is the fact that Renee is right. A lot of the problems with Apple's defense in the public eye is that a lot of these ideas are important, but they're abstract. One of them is that if this exists now, all these other governments and all these other agencies have leverage against Apple when they're making this argument. They could say that, well, we're not asking you to do something you've never done before. You've been through this. You probably have the code. Maybe you can reuse this code. Or better yet, they can argue before a judge that what we're asking Apple, what we're demanding Apple to do isn't unusual. Look, they've done it before,
It's less of a burden now. Yeah.
Yeah. And also there's the problem of, you know, there are a lot of – every single company, Apple included, the FBI included, there's somebody who's not being paid enough, or that they don't believe they're being paid enough, or they don't mm-hmm. think they're being rewarded or acknowledged enough. And those are the people that would be more than happy to, if not hand over a Bernoulli cartridge full of code, they're willing to at least say, well, here's what I saw and here's what they did. And they were talking about this method that they used to get past the encryption or get past the passcode. That's the sort of – I mean, if you can possibly avoid – giving out a piece of information that can be useful or devastating to users, why wouldn't you do that?
All right, here's a question. So again, once again, I'll just restate this. They're not asking Apple to do a backdoor into encryption.
There's a lot of scare terminology being right. used on
what they're both sides. What they're saying is, Apple, we want you to modify the firmware so we can brute force this device.
Yeah, to make brute forcing easier.
Now, here's the question. If I'm Apple, of course, I'm going to try to not do this, but I'm also going to immediately go into the lab and say, well, what can we do to prevent brute force attacks that we can't go around? Right.
Apple's been super consistent over several years about this, in which I don't know what's going on internally, but I think that it's all the signs that at some point collectively they realize that their best defense against requests like this is to simply not even have the ability.
Right. And that's why they did strong encryptions by default, starting with iOS 8. In fact, not only by default, but by you can't
and
not
iOS
do it.
iOS 9 has the 6-digit passcode by default, which
and
is
that makes
longer
it harder.
To crack. And you have the option for a password, which is effectively complete protection against
right.
this.
So, yes, that's a good point. So, in fact, they have engineered some technologies to prevent brute forcing. So that would be another response, at least going forward. It doesn't help you with older phones. Do we know? We don't know. This is a 5C, but we don't know. It is updated, apparently. We don't know if they had a 6-digit or a 4-digit code. I mean, there'd be no point.
Yeah, well, it sounds, yeah, as long as they have one of those two, I mean, it's just it, once they have a tool
six you could brute force, I guess. Just takes longer. But, and I, mean, there's, but and there's, I think we all understand that this is not this is the FBI looking for a suitable case to set a precedent as opposed to a vital piece of information or evidence that they need.
Well,
and in the letter it said too that Tim Cook said that engineers were sent there, that they tried to help as much as they could with the backup. The password was reset once it was in federal custody, which meant that the usual method, which is to pair it with a known network and let the backup happen and then help the FBI get the backup file. All of this stuff was gone through. They spent a lot of time and a lot of company money, frankly, cooperating already.
Yeah, but that's why there's so many. It gets really interesting. there's no end of interesting rat holes to go down. Actually, there are no rat holes because it's all interesting. One part of it is that this phone did not belong to the suspected terrorist. It belonged to his or her their employer, which means that they don't have to ask anything of the user of that phone. If your company has given you a phone to do your work on, that's their phone. That data you put on that is their data. They have right to access it. And the reason why they changed the password was they changed the account is that they felt as though there was a chance that somebody could remotely wipe the phone if it was still under that control. Not a smart thing for them to do, but that's why they did it. Then that's one of the reasons why I think Apple was thorough in their assistance of the FBI, because they are protecting the data of the person who owns that phone, because again it didn't belong to the person who was using it, it belonged to the company that actually purchased it.
Well, and that's why this is a perfect case for the FBI, because it eliminates a lot of issues, this is why
I'm hesitant to say that they chose this because this was a good test case. They could have picked a softer target than not only the most successful company in the world, someone who's known to have a bank checkbook that has a $230 billion balance on it, and also a company that is really good at playing the media, really very
well. But
good
also, Apple set up the confrontation by doing encryption. I mean, Android phones are not encrypted by default. The only ones that are the Google Nexus phones.
Yeah, if I was the FBI, I would have done this. If this was the result I wanted, this is the sort of case I would have led with, in the sort of way that I would have.
You wouldn't want this public discussion, but on the other hand, you're winning. So
I think that law enforcement also wants this to be a public discussion. And here's what I get at. I mean, I've been talking to law enforcement at the national level on various issues like this for at least 10 or 15 years, like I said, and different people, different situations, different real life situations and hypothetical ones. And the real professionals in that line of work have always presented to me a very, very compelling and consistent view. And I think I've mentioned it on the show before, that their job is to keep people safe, and the brakes on their behavior is what's legal, what is not legal. And if there is a tool that's available to them that can help them solve something or get information that could help them break up something that's kind of bad that could happen, and they don't use that because they don't know if it's legal or not, that's not just, well, gosh, we made more trouble for ourselves than we needed to. It is, we're not doing our job. If we think that we could solve a problem by putting a security camera on top of a public utility pole, pointing it at somebody who is on parole because they know he's going to screw up sooner or later. What do you know? At some point, he did do something that was against the law. They got the footage of it, and they were able to take him back in. It's not up to them to ask whether that is ethical or not ethical. It's only up to them to ask, is that legal or illegal? And if we, the people, feel as though that shouldn't be legal, there we can give them that guidance by saying, no, you have to pass a law saying that this isn't right. So this is why when we talk about a precedent for this, they are going to try to do this until the public or lawmakers, sometimes they're very separate groups of people, yes, tell them that, no, you can't do this. So I don't think that they picked this fight because they thought that this was a good way to fight this out. When I see cases like this, I think about those people that I talk to. And rather than thinking about a bunch of bullies who are saying, we can do this, we can do whatever you want, and you can't stop us, we're going to fight this as far as we can go, it's, you know what, we really, really think that this is an important thing for us to be able to do, and we're not going to find out whether we can continue to use this tool or not until it is proven in a court of law. And so that's why we need to we we're looking for guidance. We would like to be able to keep on doing this, and so this is why we're going to try to do this. They're not jerks. They're not cows. They're just saying that this is a tool that we find to be useful, and we'd like to continue to be able to use it.
I think that's absolutely true, but there is an old saying that directors are political animals, and assistant directors are the ones who are really part of the organization. And I think that there is a huge level of politics involved at the director level at some of these organizations, and that the views of people within it may be very different. But at the same time, we're living in a point in history where traditional breaks on these sorts of things have not been forthcoming. I mean, we're supposed to live in a society where there are checks and balances, but everything from military to law enforcement have been pushing the bounds of what, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, we would have found absolutely appalling. And not to quote Denny Crane on this, but we said that was okay. I mean, a lot of stuff that's happened would be horrifying if we were presented to it in a civil or a historical context. And we've been totally accept about it. And one of the things that happened to me immediately when I started covering the story is people saying, well, what if it was your kid? What if that phone had information about your child or your friend on it? Then you wouldn't be saying all those things. And that's absolutely true. I would be devastated. I would be destroyed. I would be screaming on the top of a mountain. And that's why we don't let victims run investigations. And that's why we don't use that argument to support torture and all sorts of other barbarism, although sometimes we do. But all these things I think are true, but I think where we're failing is we're not providing that civil oversight. If we look back over the Snowden disclosures, and we look back at some of the activities recently, never mind wiretaps from years previously, we are failing as a society to provide this sort of oversight that these law enforcement organizations need. And absent that, we're going to keep seeing stuff like that. And if Apple has to be the one that fights it, which is kind of weird to me, I don't know why politicians aren't up ahead on the front of this fighting this for us, because that's technically their job, then more power to Apple for doing it, because somebody needs to. This is going to be one of the defining arguments of our time.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it really comes down to the basic principle. I don't even think that the terrorism aspect is a guiding thing. I think that we still need to define what are the limits to our privacy as citizens. And that's something that's been very much an open issue. We've always had any time that we wanted to keep a secret from our government, the only way we had to keep that secret was to have absolutely no record of any kind, because if you can write something down on a piece of paper, you can put that in a safe, lock that safe in another safe, sink it in concrete, and then toss that concrete off the side of a barge. But the FBI would know that, well, we can send divers down, we can haul it up, we can break through the concrete, we can saw through the safe, we can get at that paper. And if that paper is in some sort of a code that Andy Natko came up with or found online, we have that code already. That's no problem. What's unprecedented is that now we have the ability as citizens to create a secret that the government can't get access to. So now we're asking, this should be a referendum on, does a private citizen have the right to know something that the government does not know? And taken to an extreme, and I'm going to acknowledge this is taken to an extreme, I'm not saying this is the real situation, but to me, the way that I feel about the importance of privacy, to say that we don't have the right to have a level of encryption, let's say, or the right to have a secret that the government can't have, is a lot like saying I don't have the right to burn that piece of paper. That has to be something that should be able to be accessed later on by an outside party. And this is why it's these kinds of issues are kind of often hard to argue, because I found myself last week, as I was thinking about this, thinking about my attitude towards gun control. And I'm not particularly against the Second Amendment. I just to put things on the table here, I think that if you are reasonable and responsible, then you want to have a firearm, you should be okay to do that. But you also should be, I feel as though if you're reasonable and responsible, then you have no problem with the government putting a limitation on what you can get, or even if you can get it. However, imagine a different podcast of someone who feels as strongly about the Second Amendment as I feel about privacy. They would be making the same, I hope, cogent and clear arguments that I know that the guns can be used for awful and unlawful purposes, but there is a basic principle that we have the right to have a firearm, and the government does not have the right to tell us we can't. And that's a rational point that's worth fighting for, according to this person's point of view. I would disagree with them, but I would say that I think you've done something. You're making at least a point that makes that I understand why you feel that way. And now we have the need to explain why, as Americans, we should stand for this. I mean, I'm running out of breath, of course, so I'm going to wind up. But the last thing I wanted to just mention is that we are unique as Americans in this sense. That in the UK, they're just, for instance, the First Amendment, the UK is used to the idea that the government can say in other European nations, we have that the government can say, no, this can't be published, or, you know, you were wrong to even say this, even though it wasn't libelous or slanderous. The UK investigatory powers bill has immense amount of control over citizens' privacy and what people can and can't say and people can and can't do. Whereas we would never, ever, ever go for something like that. The Chinese even had a problem when they were trying to pass laws to control encryption and to control privacy. This is China, where they own all the pipes in and out, communicating in and out. We are different. We are used to basically, and I'm saying this as an observation, not as a good or bad thing intrinsically. We are born as part of our national culture to think that just because the government tells us that something is in our best interests, we are going to be healthily skeptical about that, even if what they're telling us is actually in our best interests. So that's why it's really important that we think about this and we don't simply let the precedent slide that there is no circumstance under which the government cannot pressure a company or pressure an individual to give up something that is secret, no matter what the response is.
There's another huge difference with this too, and that is usually a warrant was applied for specific things. Warrants are usually not that general; they're usually very specific. But smartphones are a new kind of thing. They consist of many more parts. For example, the government might be interested in my communications, but if they get my phone, they also get my health records, my financial information, my location as it's been tracked over time. The amount of information, it's sort of like in the old days, it was in your head, and no one would sort of want the government to have telepathy and be able to bury through your head and find out everything about you. You probably immediately put up alarm bells. But this is the closest thing we've actually had to telepathy because it keeps a running record of everything in your life. No one specific instance. Everyone you've talked to, every place that you've gone, every step that you've taken, every blood pressure, almost everything about you, every payment you've made. And that is an incredible amount of information that in most cases is far beyond the scope of any warrant but would be available immediately to anybody who had access to it.
I need to point out that and we're not lawyers – but in general, that only information discovered specified in the warrant would be able to be used in court. So
immediately.
Yes, if you get in somebody's house, you can see stuff that may incriminate them in other cases. But that warrant's very specific about what you're looking for, and you may not use that other material. In fact, there was a Supreme Court case. Antonin Scalia wrote a very interesting majority decision on this case in which police officers who were had a warrant to go look for a gun because somebody shot a hole in the wall, then thought to look at the serial numbers on the back of the stereo equipment and found out it was stolen. They arrested the guys for stealing stereo equipment and then went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled they could not use that evidence. They could not use those serial numbers because that wasn't what the warrant was for. So it isn't the case, in my opinion, of course, that may not be the case, but because I'm not a lawyer, but it isn't the case. I don't believe that you can just say, "Well, I got everything on the phone. Let's see what else is there."
You're protected.
You're protected against that. In theory,
but with this, they take for permanent data control. So that's the only difference.
I understand they have access to everything, but in theory, they're not allowed to use it.
Yeah, but that raises for me an even larger problem when law enforcement tries to determine that they don't need a warrant to get certain pieces of information.
Well, that's pen registers and a lot of metadata and so forth.
I just want to point out that's
a different argument. Now you're arguing against what is the law of the land based on.
No. I'm sorry. I hope that was really clear that when I talked about how I opposed the basic principle that there is no piece of data that the government can't force a company to give up, apart from, you know, if they're being investigated for wire fraud, okay, yes, they have to give that stuff up. But there's no piece of information that a consumer can't have that the government shouldn't be able to decrypt. I'm saying that it's oftentimes you start off with agreeing with something as a citizen because it really is a really good idea. Anti-drunk driving roadblocks. The problem is that that's a good idea, particularly on New Year's Eve when there's a lot of drunk driving fatalities, especially when the law enforcement has numbers saying that here's the number of accidents that we were able to take off the road because we had these driving stops. But then there are it gets the step number two. I got off track. A better case is the RICO Act, where the idea was let's cut off these organized crime by simply being able to seize assets that are involved in drug transactions. Like if you bought yourself a $10 million house and we know that you got it through drug money, we can take the house. And if you bought yourself an $8,000 solid gold cowboy hat, we can take that hat and then take that money away from you. And that was a very, very good idea. But now you see that years later, it's being used as stopping people for not being a white dude when they're driving. And then they've got $800 in cash on them and simply saying that we have reason to believe that you would not be driving this car in this neighborhood with $800 in cash unless you were doing it for a drug transaction. So we're going to seize this $800 in cash and then literally buy ourselves a margarita maker for the station house. And you will not be able to get it back. There's going to be at least a 3 or 4 year process that will cost you many thousands of dollars to get it back. And this all started because we started with this principle that we should be able to seize private assets and not have a speedy way of demonstrating why this was being seized and why it shouldn't be returned. This is why when you talk about fighting for a principle, oftentimes you are talking about deeply abstract things that are hard to make a convincing argument about. But I agree.
So your point is that it's a slippery – that there are slippery slopes. But I think a lot of the argument against this – from the tech community is just in general a mistrust of government. And that's a perfectly legitimate argument to have, but that's not
blind faith in Apple is bad. I'm not even saying that.
That's not the discussion here. Mm-hmm. The discussion here is how Apple would resist a court order, not whether Apple should not honor a court order, I think it really muddies the waters to say, well, it's the government, so just screw it. I think you have to really focus on the facts of the case. And then if you want to have a discussion in a separate time about whether the government sucks, that's another matter. But it's not germane here, is my opinion. I think the slippery slope argument is germane. If what you're saying is, well, we got to be careful because this is a slippery slope. That's
precedence
relevant,
which the law is based on.
Right. That's relevant. I don't think this is about arguing whether it's a good law or a bad law at this point. I think.
But that's not helpful
because it's not what's going to happen here.
I'm trying to find the most clear way of phrasing it because sometimes it's possible to choose the wrong words and create the wrong impression. I've come to understand is that this sort of appeals process is not about basically saying that you can't make me do something I don't want to do. A lot of this stuff, when it gets sort of sent to higher and higher courts, is based on the idea of, I don't think you're right. You're the government and you've made a really nice argument on a thick stack of paper on why you think this law should be applied here. I don't think you're right. I think that
the branch of the government that decides that, which is called the courts, right? That's the government as well. So it's appropriate for the courts to decide this, unless you want to argue against that. But I believe that that is not the argument we should be having at this point. It's not whether it's appropriate for the courts to decide this. That's why you fight it in court.
What I was about to say was that it is completely appropriate for Apple to resist this through the means they're using to do this.
Exactly.
And basically insist that this is an important enough and a vague enough request that we need the, if necessary, the highest court in the land to tell us that this has to happen.
Yes.
And that
I completely agree.
We don't want, exactly. That's the only point that I'm making.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. Bill Gates, and actually he's disputing this. I don't know which is true or not.
It's so confusing.
In the Financial Times, Bill Gates says that it's very simple. Apple should, in fact, do this. This is a specific case where the government is asking for access to information. They're not asking for some general thing. They're asking for a particular case. I love his analogy. He says, no different than whether anybody should ever have been able to tell the phone company to get information. Should anybody be able to get a bank register? Let's say the bank had tied a ribbon around the disk drive and said, don't make us cut this ribbon because once we do, you're going to make us do it many times. I think the argument Apple's going to make is not that. The argument is it's an undue burden to cut the ribbon.
Although their argument is that it's a ribbon cutter. They're not asking for Apple to cut the ribbon. Apple, I believe, would probably be a ribbon cutter. They're asking for a ribbon cutter, which is what Apple.
But are they really? I mean, if Apple does this, does the FBI get something they can use over and over again? I don't
believe
so.
The precedent to get them to keep doing this sort of.
But that's the point.
This tool, yeah.
Okay. So that's what I'm saying. The bank says, "Don't. If I cut this ribbon, that's going to set a precedent." That's Apple, by the way, will not be able to argue that in court. The only argument that they can pursue in court is that it's an undue burden.
Creating this tool is an undue burden on them for X and Y reasons. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
We can argue about precedent, but that's not germane in this case. I mean, it's not going to be.
But just the analogy, and Zdarsky again on his – I might be pronouncing his last name wrong.
Zdarsky
on his blog makes a very clear, because again, forensic tools expert, that they're not asking them to cut the ribbon, that there's been cases of ribbon cutting before and companies have complied. Why Apple is not complying in this case is that they are asking for a ribbon cutter
that's what I'm really curious about. And that's the technical question, which is, if Apple does this for this one phone, is this in some way usable again? I understand there's precedent, but I'm just asking about the technology.
Yeah, so from a technology point of view, everyone from Christina Warren, I think, had a really good article on this, but everyone from Zdarsky to Will Strafik, you know, the people who know iOS from people who jailbroke it, people whose job it was to attack iOS, have said repeatedly that this sort of thing is a ribbon cutter, not cutting the ribbon.
Okay, that's important. That's a big deal, because we don't want to give them a ribbon cutter.
Yeah, and another big deal would be if Apple, even if they were to deliberately say, okay, well, we were forced to do this, and so we broke this phone for this 5C for this one case. We are now going to make sure a new feature of 9.3, which we're going to withhold for the next 6 weeks, is to create a brand new system that we don't know how to break yet. So that if there is a future request for a future phone or for a future OS, we can say that, well, that was with the 5C. It will not work with our new version of the OS.
Well, and Apple has been doing this up until iOS 8. They didn't like it. They didn't want to do it, but that's why they created iOS 8's full disk encryption. But they have been doing this all along, haven't they?
And they're still doing it with iCloud backups, which don't have the same level of encryption as on-device hardware.
Right. And Apple, as far as we know, there's no example. And I'm using an opinion piece by former LAPD Chief of Police Bill William Bratton. He says there's no evidence that the fact that Apple did this before gave law enforcement any tool to continue to do it.
Because they did it directly, so that was cutting the ribbon. Apple has cut the ribbon repeatedly. Although there's language, they're arguing that they haven't unlocked 70 phones, that they did something different. So there is some vagary about what exactly is being defined there. But again, that would be cutting the ribbon, and their objection is to making a ribbon cutter.
I am still on the fence, to be honest with you. I think it's pretty apparent. I think on the one hand, I understand the arguments of why this is a bad precedent. But I'm not completely convinced that this is a ribbon cutter. And I do believe that if Apple could do this in a one-time-only case, they should absolutely help law enforcement in this one-time-only case. If it were a question of Apple giving law enforcement a tool that they could use forever to get into people's iPhones, that would be a very different matter.
That's where the line is blurry, because this tool, I mean, there is no specific way to make this tool a one-off. They could encode the IMEI number into it, but then it was just a matter of, well, we have another phone. Can you do it for this IMEI? Yeah, fine. Well, you have 20 more phones. We have 100 more phones. And then if they change the security, well, you've already done it for this. So now you got to make a version that works with your new security protocols. There is no way to constrain this to one phone, at least technologically, at least.
Yeah, I mean, we are talking about, I think that one thing we've been maybe unclear with to this point is that we're basically having a conversation about two different topics, one of which is this specific case, and another one is an equally important discussion about the principles of privacy in a digital age.
Right.
And one of those difficulties is indeed, once it becomes easy for law enforcement to get access to a device, then you stop. What we've seen in previous technologies is that it stops being something where we're, you know how much paperwork we're going to have to do to get access to this evidence? We got to make sure that if we're making this request, this is the most important piece of evidence we can collect on this case, and that this case is so important that we do have to go into these sort of things. When it becomes as easy as somebody signs off something internally and then clicks a button to generate an automated electronic request, that's when you start going from 12 requests a year to 12 requests a day. and fishing expeditions. This is the same sort of idea where you would never have law enforcement would never park a police car by the side of a highway and have a guy writing down every single license plate number of every single car that passes by. That would be way too difficult. But if you can have a box that costs a couple of tens of thousands of dollars that will simply collect all that automatically. Okay, that's useful. We can do that. Whether it's a question of violation of civil liberties, again, that's a question for the courts to decide. But they will do things that are easy if they are easy. Once you make them sort of have to work for personal information, that's when you don't get people saying, gosh, we need some movement on this case. Or it would be, I think that there's something about in this avenue we need to take a look at, but I don't know what yet. That's when you start to, these middle-of-the-road cases start to go away.
And it's not just privacy, it's security too. I mean, the two are often intermingled, but they're not exactly the same. And you can have one or the other, or you can have both. And once it gets to a point where it is a simple firmware replace, even if there's a lot of safeguards on it, that effectively weakens the security of iOS. And that, again, is why Apple said this leaves it open to hackers, to malware, to foreign intelligence companies. Every time I read one of these FBI statements, I just replace FBI with Chinese intelligence. And I ask myself, does that sound like a good idea? Right. And if it's not a good idea for Chinese intelligence, it's probably not a good idea for the FBI. Because it's not just America. Yeah. It's the world, unfortunately.
Chief Bratton quotes the case of Baton Rouge, Louisiana woman, Brittany Mills, 29 years old, who was 8 months pregnant when she was murdered. Apple says it cannot comply with a search warrant and open her iPhone, even though the police believe the identity of the killer is actually contained in her device. He says, Ms. Mills was an Apple customer. So were some of the people who died with iPhones in their pockets in the San Bernardino and Paris attacks. How is not solving a murder or not finding the message that might stop the next terrorist attack protecting anyone? I think that's an interesting question.
Yeah.
And he also mentions Google. Google, I'm not sure where Google stands on all of this. Sundar Pichai tweeted his support for Apple, as has Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. But I don't know if they've been presented with this situation or not. See, some of this happens all the time in secrecy. In fact, this would have happened in secrecy had the FBI acceded to Apple's request to seal the case.
Yeah, and of course, Android is a lot more understood than Apple hardware is, than Apple's operating systems are. And that points out another difference between these two kinds of cases, where there's also a question to be asked where, let's say that we collectively decide that this is a good thing. Should Apple be now required that part of their business is unlocking every phone that law enforcement ever presents to them? That, again, it's not going to be a short list because, again, these aren't people who want to surveil on private citizens just for fun. It literally is because of cases like that. They feel as though if this data is on the phone, if we can make sure we know who did it, we actually know who did it. We just need to prove it. How do we not use this tool if this is presented to us? I can see a world in which there's an entire department of Apple. They got to pull more people off the Apple Music project just to satisfy these requests almost.
Internationally, yeah.
I mean, Apple can afford it.
Well, but I mean, at a certain scale, it's like
Apple makes a lot of money making these phones. This may be a reasonable tax on the money that it's able to make on these phones, that it should spend a small fraction of that to support law enforcement. I don't think that's unreasonable.
It's not, but again, it's one of those things that as soon as you make, like, for this to scale, it will have to go beyond Apple. We just had another data leak from the Canadian government. It is almost impossible to keep these things secret. And once you make a phone that's easy for people to access, it's going to be accessed by everybody. And that, again, it becomes not a privacy issue, but a security issue. And are people even going to want... Fixing this for Apple is fine. Other people are going to just use encrypted communication systems. That's fine. But you're weakening the security of people who do their banking and keep their health information and keep all sorts, very personal pictures on their phone. It's essentially undermining the security of everyone who does everything on those devices. And yeah, in a perfect world, there'd be a way to have something that could only ever be accessed by law enforcement, only ever under the pure application of law. But as we've seen repeatedly, anytime security is opened, people rush right in. And this is one of those things where sometimes there is a price to pay for a certain amount of liberty. And this feels to me like one of those times where if we want to be secure, then we have to do a different kind of law enforcement or a different kind of analysis or go to other sources than what's on a hardware device.
We're going to table this because I think we had a good conversation, and we have to take a break. Just a program note, Steve Gibson is in the chat room. He has said he is going to talk a little bit about this on Security Now right after the show, and he says he believes it is not a ribbon cutter. It is a one-shot deal, and he'll tell us why. So that's something that's unclear, and might very well change how you feel about this case. If this could be done one time only without giving anybody a tool to do this on any other phone again, then what would you say? And that's part of the reason I don't credit polls, because we've discussed this now on Twit for many, many hours, and I'm still not sure because some of the facts are not known.
And also, we also all have to admit that there is immense stuff that even the three of us have no idea about what works and what doesn't work inside the iPhone. None of us are lawyers, and even if we're lawyers, we don't work in law enforcement.
Right.
So that's why it's so hard to say anything. I think the only thing that I can speak about with absolutely 100% authenticity and confidence is how do I feel about broad principles? Because when you get down to, is this legal or is this right or should they ask? It's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Thank you for paying me for saying I don't know, but I got to say, I don't know.
Well, and we came out of this discussion on Twit with this conclusion, which I think we can all agree on, which is it is a false assumption to say that breaking security in any way makes you more secure, that it is for the safety, and the NSA feels this, by the way. In fact, the former head of the NSA just said this. It is in the national interest that encryption, end-to-end encryption, be available and secure. That protects us as much as it hurts us, and more than it hurts us. And so that's a really important discussion. But I think the takeaway for a lot of us, and I hope that American people can kind of get their head around this, is that true security requires strong, unbroken, unbackdoored end-to-end encryption, period, full stop. And we all agree, I think, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there you go. Let's take a break. It's a great thing to talk about. Deep philosophical case, lots of implications. I hope that we can trust our courts, because if we can't, we're in deep trouble. And of course the courts aren't always right. Nobody's always, nothing's always correct, but we live in a land of laws, and as you do in Canada. And that is one of the true lasting strengths of our countries is we are a nation of laws. And even if we disagree with the 2000 election results, let's say, we can transition to a new president and we will all agree to adhere to what the Supreme Court says, period.
Yeah.
No matter how much we disagree with that.
Or Cape Breton.
Yeah. Or when Nixon was impeached, many countries were amazed that we could lose a national leader and so smoothly transition to his vice president without any ripples. And that is one of the strengths of this country. We are a nation of laws. And if anybody's ever lived or been to a nation where the law is undermined or corrupt, they know how important that is.
I'll just say we're super lucky in that we're just so there's such a system of checks and balances here. I like a lot of people, I've been thinking about, OK, what if Trump gets elected? What if that happens?
Got the guest room ready, Andy.
Yeah, exactly.
Cape Breton. We're all moving to Cape Breton. I thought the same thing, Andy, and I came to the same conclusion I think you have, which is,
it'll be okay because if there's an idiot in the White House that has no business and no experience being there, all the judiciary and
it's
the legislative
set up
branches
to handle
are
that.
They're not going to step up and say, you know, we need to do what's good right for the case of the country. None of them will do that, though. They're going to say, hey, power vacuum. Awesome.
Yeah.
Let's take advantage of
this. The founding fathers foresaw. And amazingly enough, foresaw a situation in which one or two of the branches of government was corrupt or stupid or inept. And it has happened many times in this nation, and we have survived. And there are many, many people, including many of my relatives, who think that we've been through the 8 years of stupidity and corruption. And in fact, there are many people in the chat room who believe that, and we have survived. So, and then we survived because we, as a nation, agree to follow the law.
We love our country. We don't love we like the people who lead our country, but we love our country. As much as we can make fun of NASCAR events that has like waving flags and flyovers, It's like, as much as we might like Obama, as much as we might have liked Reagan, it was not these people that we followed. And when they got replaced, we still had the thing we really loved, which is America. I hate to be that sappy, but that's the case.
Yeah, it's not sappy, actually. It's an important point. And it's one of the reasons Apple, I know, will do what the courts end up saying. Even they'll fight it to the Supreme Court, but if the Supreme Court rules against them, they will do it. Because this is a nation of laws. Speaking of laws, we're brought to you today by LegalZoom. This is a nation of laws, not necessarily of lawyers. Sometimes.
What a pro. Little report, ladies and gentlemen.
No, sometimes.
Really let him hear it.
You don't need a lawyer to get the law on your side. In fact, this is a great time to get your life organized with LegalZoom. Do you have a family? Do you have assets or property? If that's the case, you better have an estate plan. And I know that says, oh, estate plan? I don't have an estate. Yes, you do. And if you die intestate, the court gets to decide what to do. It's time to indicate your interests with LegalZoom. It's actually very simple. LegalZoom's estate plan bundle eliminates the guesswork. They walk you through it step by step. You don't have to figure out on your own whether a will or a living trust works best for you. In fact, if you want advice, you can even get an independent attorney available in most states. Now, LegalZoom's not a law firm, but they have negotiated, pre-negotiated rates with attorneys in most states. So even if you feel like, I got to ask some questions, they can set that up for you. They'll walk you through their options. They'll recommend an estate plan that offers the best solution to fit your needs. And because they're not a law firm, you know how much it's going to cost right up front. You can count on efficiency and value everything on your terms, on your schedule. You'll know what it's going to cost. You're not paying an hourly rate. That's how LegalZoom has become the leader in helping small business owners like me set up our LLCs, our S-Corps, our corporations, our trademarks and patents, and families set up their wills and living trusts. You get legal help. You get what you need. You walk away feeling great. And you know you want to do this, and you're probably put off by the potential cost and complexity. It's not expensive. It's not complex. It's LegalZoom. Get your life organized with an estate plan bundle at LegalZoom.com today. Don't forget to enter MBW in the referral box at checkout. That's MBW at LegalZoom.com. And we thank LegalZoom for their support. Take a deep breath, everybody.
We shall survive this.
Yeah. Let's see. What do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about the Channel 5 in San Francisco report that there were loud clangings and bangings coming in the middle of the night?
So my understanding is that Apple has had offices in Sunnyvale for a long time and that the lawyers have been based there for a long time. So my guess is midnight barbecue. That's just top of my head.
My friend, I actually caught this. I was watching the local news, which I rarely do. And I watched because my friend Mike Sugarman, good friend, I've known him for years, was the reporter. Listen.
City doesn't either.
Speculation is, I'll go back and start at the beginning here.
Well, Alan, we don't know what's going on inside these buildings in Sunnyvale, but what we found out today is the city doesn't either. Speculation is that Apple is building its driverless car and testing it in here.
That's wild speculation.
They certainly don't want anybody to know what's going on. They've got fences like this one up all over the place. Now, building the driverless car, that's no big deal. That's legal. It's nothing against Sunnyvale codes. But what would be a problem is the noise that's keeping neighbors up all night. And we found out the city didn't know about that either. Last night, we told you about weird noises and secret doings in these Sunnyvale buildings.
Secret doings?
3 in the morning, they have deliveries. It's very dark over there, so they're very secretive. We don't know what's going on. But almost
there's
every night,
dog
there's noise
barking.
That wakes the dogs up.
Maybe Apple's
city
annoyed by your dog.
The blog several years ago
that?
Gave a clue saying that Apple had been granted a permit for an auto testing.
Isn't that interesting? That happened years ago, and nobody picked up on it.
This car from the computer giant might be being built there.
What's going on in that factory that everybody's?
He's talking to
about?
A Sunnyvale.
You'd have to ask Apple that.
Sunnyvale
outside
city
of that mention in the blog, the city admits it has no idea what in fact is going on here.
Security cameras. Look at—he's pounding on the door.
Hello. Apple did not return a phone call nor answer the door at one of the several buildings on this block on San Gabriel Road, where the noise is coming from.
Nobody's here. It's the cats
up at night.
You're like. Sheets of metal slamming, you'll hear like clanking, you'll hear almost a grinding sound.
They're deploying the Knight Rider.
This was always such a nice, quiet neighborhood.
And that's the thing. It's interesting. It's not an industrial area, really. It's a neighborhood.
The city admits it didn't know that either until our story last night.
We saw your coverage about that story and looked into city complaints, and we actually couldn't find anything.
She's asking neighbors to let the city know so they can send inspectors and police officers out, even in the middle of the night. But as for if Apple is building its long-rumored but never-confirmed driverless car, the city of Sunnyvale is in the dark as well as everybody else.
Isn't that funny? Thank you, Mike.
Chinese inspectors trying to get in there.
What do you think they're doing? It could just be some body work, right?
Maybe Eddie and Phil doing karaoke. Where they get those pictures for Dub Dub.
Yeah. I just suddenly got this wonderful idea that we should just basically hire some sort of a shop in LA to build the stupidest, most ridiculous looking car imaginable, and then like late at night, like we just basically crash it outside there and then try to prevent everybody from taking pictures of the crash. And just say, no, that doesn't belong to anybody. Just shut up. You didn't see this. It'll be all over the entire world that we've got pictures of the first Apple car.
Tim Cook gave a Fortune interview. Among many of the things they talked about, Apple car was one of them. He says Apple's only exploring cars. They're not yet committed.
Yeah.
We don't have to spend large amounts to explore, so I can't talk about this certain area you're talking about. But when we start spending large amounts of money, we're committed at that point, but we explore things with teams of people, and that's part of being curious. Once we start spending gobs of money, like when we start spending on tooling and things like that, well, then we're committed.
How many Alexes are in a gob?
By the way, it's Adam Leshinsky in the interview, and if you're going to pick one guy, a guy to interview Tim Cook, that's a good guy. Adam really knows his stuff. He was at Apple headquarters a couple of days before Valentine's Day. He also asked him about this. By the way, Tim says, I'm good at blocking out the noise, but I don't think he's talking about the noise coming from Sunnyvale. He's talking about the critics. Tim actually says, I don't listen to the critics. Are we doing the right things? Are we remembering our North Star? Are we focusing on making the best products that really help people enrich their lives in some way? By the way, we talked a lot about whether Tim was a good replacement for Steve Jobs and whether he was worthy and whether Steve would be happy with how Tim's running the company. Can I just point out now that Tim Cook, with his letter, open letter to the people of the United States about this Department of Justice thing, with his principled stands in many ways, he has shown himself to be a great leader at Apple and a man of moral vision. I'm very impressed by Tim Cook. You agree?
And he means what he says. He's incredibly sincere when he speaks about this.
Even more so than Jobs was. Jobs, I don't want to say anything about Steve, but I feel like Tim is looking at the North Star. He has a very strong moral compass. And I'm very impressed by the guy. I think Apple's in very good hands. And man, he has rapidly risen to be a premier CEO.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say that I knew Jobs well or at all. I can't say that I've met Tim more than once and it was inconsequential. But I can say that he definitely has proven himself to be the right sort of successor to Steve Jobs. If they had someone who's was very, very good at keeping their nose on the status book and talking a lot with stiff motions when they are presented with a camera, I don't think that people would have enjoyed that transition. It wouldn't have been appropriate for Apple. But you have someone that you feel – I think that it seems as though one of the most important things that Apple needed for the transition is to still have Apple led by someone where you feel as though this is how somebody thinks. This person has a perspective and a point of view, and that point of view is Apple's, but it will be expressed through all of their products. So you know that this is not the sort of person who would make a triangular phone just because he thought triangles were cool that week.
Yeah. Yeah, it is definitely his Apple at this point, and all to the good, by the way.
There's a great—I just put it in the Google Doc, but there's a great video from Steve Jobs from All Things Digital from 2010 where he sort of stakes the ground for Apple and privacy and why it's going to be increasingly important, and it sort of shows that this is a value that's been core to the company, if not forever, then certainly for a long time.
Yeah, I have to say though, you've got to think that Tim Cook Because he's gay in a world in which it's still illegal in many areas to be gay, it's certainly discriminated against and probably led much of his life in fear of that, probably is more in touch with the importance of privacy than maybe Steve Jobs would have been. Although Steve didn't want to have his license plate seen. So
it's that paving that brick, you know, like he asked very clearly when he did that letter where he came out, the op-ed piece, that he wants to put down his bricks on that road the way that that Kennedy did. And this, this is him sort of living up to that.
It's amazing.
I wouldn't speculate, but.
It's speculation. I'll grant you that.
No.
Well, it is a huge risk for any, like there are a lot of ways to put your head down. And a lot of tech companies are doing that right now, put their heads down and try not to get any attention or collateral damage from that. And he's putting Apple, regardless of what you believe and who you think is right or wrong, he has put Apple right in the front lines of this.
Yeah. Go ahead. Did you want to say something, Andy?
No.
Okay. I like that look.
Only that I have a thought, but it's, I don't know if I can express it accurately, so I can. It's okay for me not to say anything.
He did. Adam did ask Tim whether we've reached peak iPhone. That's been kind of like the the phrase that's been bandied about of late. Yeah. That maybe the iPhone is, you know, and Apple themselves gave the guidance.
Kantar said peak phone, peak smartphone today. So, I mean, it's a general question.
I think it's true, really, that we have reached peak phone. He says no. Tim says there's a lot more gas in that tank. Let me see if I can find that quote.
For any vendor, they can jockey for share, but it'll get, like, there's eventually a point where everybody will have a phone. Maybe everyone will have two phones. And unless Mars opens up as a market, it'll be about getting the biggest share of that existing pie.
Not only that, but Apple's in such a great position where when you're talking about high margin luxury phones, that's pretty. Obviously, Samsung has a lot of interest in the S6 and the S7, but that's the phone. If you're going to make 40%, 30% margin on a phone, that's the one that everybody wants. So it doesn't, their market share, I wouldn't say that it doesn't matter, but it's almost like you really want to see how much money is being spent on phones and how much of that is Apple capturing.
Right.
And you don't often get bundles on the day of launch the way you see with some other luxury phones where they are $700, but we'll give you this headset and this watch and this discount and this other phone. But they're keeping a lot of that money.
Yeah, but that's interesting because it does go to show you that if there are people who can be who are not, you know, I can't get over the precision of that chamfer angle on the new iPhone. It's like, I want to have this quality. I don't care that you engineers spent 2.5 years on the index of refraction on the specific kind of glass that was made exactly for your phone. This other guy is going to give me free headphones, so I'm taking the free headphones.
All the ports are aligned. It's just, it's exactly. A harmony in my life.
He also said the new headquarters, he hopes to start moving in about a year. I know how he feels. I am kind of in the same boat. he says, think of it as early 2017. There's lots of excitement about it. It gets a lot of people back together again, which I think is really important. In other words, many employees who are now spread throughout many buildings will be back in one building. It'd be nice to get everybody back, he says. Here's a great question, Adam. Have you made a decision on the naming of the campus? Yeah. Have you settled on the way that you'll pay homage to Steve Jobs? We're talking about it, says Tim. We will definitely honor him in the right kind of way. We're working with Loreen and the family.
Yeah.
Nice.
Because Infinite Loop doesn't have a name. Like Apple Campus is just Apple Campus. There's no real name for it. So people just kept calling this campus too, but it is an interesting question.
Would you call it the Steve Jobs campus? I think you do, right?
I don't know.
Or does Apple just call it campus too? I mean, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, they made Infinite Loop famous, even though it was just a little pun that at the time 8 people are going to understand. But what actually made me start to think, now that this thing is taking greater shape, is Apple seems like exactly the sort of company that would buy or commission some wonderful art to go inside there.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of wondering, are they going to commission some? They are going to have, remember, their own sort of like private park in there that's beautifully landscaped, that's really beautifully cultivated. You walk through Boston's Public Garden and you see it was built at a time where public art and public statuary was just exploding. And you wonder if Apple is thinking that there are going to be people who are going to be walking through this pathway and through this green space for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. What do we want them to see in 40 years' time? And then commissioning a piece of art to stand there and be everywhere. Mm. You think about them. They're going to have murals. Are they going to have murals in there? Are they actually just going to go into a collecting phase? Art holds its value pretty well. So they could just simply say, we really love this artist. And so we're basically putting some of our using our Irish checkbook. We decided to buy these three works and basically have this play where everybody, all of our workers, when they're going to personnel and back through this one main atrium, are going to get to see one of these beautiful works of art.
Apple Pencil may not be used for navigation. iOS 9.3 and fourth betas came out for that, for tvOS, watchOS, and OS 10. It's been nice. They've been all in sync. Yep. The last few iterations, but some people are a little upset because, in fact, I've seen there's been Twitter. I think there's a hashtag because you can't use the Apple Pencil for navigation, according to Mac rumors. It appears to be intentional. You agree, Renee?
It's interesting. Esfenerty did a really long piece on this yesterday, where she sort of delved into the issue. But so what's happened is the pencil layer is actually a completely separate layer from multi-touch. And multi-touch is what we traditionally use to navigate. And Apple believed that expected behavior was, I do the same thing with the pencil, I get the same result. So they went through and duplicated all the navigational behavior using the pencil input mechanism. Those things don't have to be linked, but the early thinking was that we're just going to assume they are. So let's give us the behavior that we assume. And now it seems to be that people are saying, well, if you de-link these, then you get a whole bunch of other behaviors. For example, you can draw with one hand while you're moving things around with the other hand, and you don't have to. It behaves more like a traditional pencil, where what you're doing with the pencil doesn't really affect the paper. Those are two discrete objects that you can manipulate independently. And there's a few people on Twitter who seem to like this idea, but most people are very much against it because it's very hard to take a feature away from somebody. You almost never want to do that.
Yes.
And you've let people navigate with this. And some people like CGP Grey, who has RSI, or other people who've just been used to doing it this way now for 6 months, suddenly they can't do it anymore. That's not a good situation. It's not a good user experience. Obviously, someone inside Apple seems to think this is a really important step, and maybe there is some future feature that depends on it, and Apple's really not good about communicating that kind of stuff. John Gruber had an interesting suggestion, which is to make it a toggle, which everyone is loath to do when you add more settings, but it feels like one of those things where that's really the best answer, because for some people, the best experience is always going to be, I want to play a game, I can't reach this sort of the keyboard, this edge of the screen, I just want to be able to, and to be clear, we're not talking about buttons, we're talking about things like scrolling, swiping, and doing multi-touch gestures with the pencil. I want to be able to do those things with this implement. And you'll have a few other people who say, really, I want to be able, when I learn to draw, you erase with one hand, you draw with the other. And that's a really natural thing. And people are going to want to do that. So it seems like if this is a deliberate choice, that it would be better, like with the multi-touch swipe gestures they introduced back in iOS 4, that they make this something that we get to choose ourselves.
Yeah. I just don't like it when companies make a dogmatic decision, simply saying that, well, the reason why we're not going to put this in the iPad Pro is because we can't also make it available for the iPad Mini. And so unless we could be, when our dogma says that we have to have a consistent experience throughout all platforms, saying, no, you don't. You have to give the user what you have to make the best experience you can for various implementations of the word best experience. And if you notice that people are using the pencil in a certain way, you should really, and it's not an undue burden upon you to put in that option, you should put in that option. That's the one thing that always makes me nuts, when it's like, you can tell that there is, unless you're going to tell me that there's a real reason why you decided to delete this feature, I just don't want to know that you deleted it because you have a rule of only six buttons, never more than six buttons. And that would have been button number seven.
Yeah, the people who care about this really care about it.
Yeah, I care about it. I want to be able to use it for, I think it's a mistake, but. We'll see.
On the broader issue, there's so much work for them to do in enhancing the experience of the iPad Pro. I love mine. I'm never outside the house without it. I'm going to be going to Yosemite for an entire week. I'm going to be shooting hundreds of photos a day, and I'm still convinced that I'm not going to need to bring my MacBook with me. But nonetheless, it is at times painfully clear that you need to let me navigate through these. When you present me with a list and I can actually highlight things with the arrow keys, you need to let me tap the enter button instead of having to physically tap on that with my finger.
That
you
should
need
be
to
fixed.
Add these shortcuts. And that's just stupid. I mean, it's yeah. Okay. I'm
that was a run. They ran out of time. Thing was that one, but yeah.
Yeah, and I know it's, but it's like it seems like the sort of thing where it would, as a developer, it would annoy me to no end that I would have this device in front of me. It's like when you're in a restaurant and you see one picture on the wall of all those photographs. It's a little bit out there. It's like, I'd excuse myself to go to the bathroom, then run over there and fix it, because it just kills me that that is not right.
There we go.
But that's what I'm talking about. I hope that they are internally acknowledging that the iPad Pro is a brand new thing. It's a separate thing. It's not even an iPad. It's not even a MacBook, but it is its own unique beast, and as such has its own unique opportunities for greatness.
Actually, I should credit Mike Hurley and his Overcast podcast on Relay FM. He was the one who said, quote, sources in the know confirm that removing the functionality of the Apple Pencil is a decision inside of Apple. It's not a bug they have overlooked for three betas. It's intentional. It's a decision.
Yeah, no,
yeah, I think.
Same way putting it there.
But something's in three betas, that's kind of like a signal.
Yeah.
Have you been playing with new betas? Have you seen anything else you want to report, Renee?
The stuff is still in the Apple TV is the stuff I'm excited about the most, which is the Siri dictation.
Yeah.
Just being able to do that is so much easier than using that keyboard.
And, can I dictate a password?
Yeah, I mean, depending on the ability of Siri to parse what you're saying, you know, like lowercase a, tilde. It depends on the complications of your password. But yeah, I mean, theoretically, and there's some nice stuff like Live Photos lets you pull out a specific frame now. And lets you choose whether you want to save it as a moving picture or just pull out the static image. And there's a bunch of really cool stuff in there.
Andy, you say you like the Pro. Did you see the Huawei Mate?
Yeah.
Announced at Mobile World Congress yesterday.
Yeah, this is an iPad size Windows 10 device. It's all based on the Atom processor, so it doesn't have like the speed of an i5 or an i3 or an i7. But it is roughly the same price as an iPad Pro. It runs full desktop software. It has a really nice mated keyboard with it. And it really... My eye would have been wondering if this had been available at the exact same time as the iPad Pro. I'm still convinced that the iPad Pro was absolutely the right choice for me. But if I were not already invested in the iPad, I'd be like, yay, Windows 10.
The only negative is it's Windows 10.
Well, that's the thing that reminded me. So we didn't talk about this because it happened after last week too, but they put out that profile of Johnny Tsurugi, and they were sort of talking about the creation of the iPad and how it really was supposed to be out earlier and use an A8, but then the things like the pencil and stuff weren't finished yet, and they decided to put it on A9X, and Apple had to sort of sprint to get the A9X out 6 months before they had originally planned to. Sort of everything that went into the decisions to make that processor and that tablet and the set of conditions and get it out on time, I thought was just beyond fascinating.
The real threat that the Huawei MateBook presents is not to Apple, of course, but to Microsoft and their Surface Pro, because it's very much like a Surface Pro, but very thin. It's kind of like an iPad form factor for a Windows PC. I mean, it's not a tablet; it's a PC.
I'm not so sure. I mean, the Surface isn't a proof of concept. It's not a Nexus device where they're trying to encourage other hardware developers to go along these lines. It is a for real product, but nonetheless, the whole point of everything that Microsoft does is to keep Windows relevant and to keep Windows looking essential. And that they are very aware that they've totally lost the game when it comes to phones. But a lot of their thinking right now is to make sure that we don't get into a world in which everybody wants, if someone is spending less than $800 on a computer, they're definitely going to be buying an iPad or an Android tablet. Why would you buy a Windows tablet? Right. So that's one of the reasons why Windows 10 has become taken in the direction it has. And that's why they're really eager to work with Intel to make sure that their desktop operating system will work well on a mobility enhanced processor like the Core series.
It's super interesting, too, that, you know, for a long time we talked about how wouldn't it be great if Intel would just start fabbing Apple processors, because you'd get sort of the best of both worlds. And now we're seeing a time where Huawei can put this on Atom, or Apple can do the A9, or Samsung can fab something. And they're almost all great. Like, the fabs almost have all identical processes. They're all doing great work. And we have actual legitimate choice across all the – Qualcomm is doing interesting stuff. NVIDIA is getting into this. It's way more diverse ecosystem than we ever had on the Wintel days.
Yeah.
And if you know, if you could be in that position where if you wanted to still use your iMac and still be a Mac person, but just be a little bit invested in Windows because you need something that, for heaven's sake, you can still be able to access a file system on a tablet, that's still kind of a pain point with using my iPad Pro for stuff. It's not insane for you to have a Windows tablet and have a Mac notebook or a Mac desktop. And that's why I just what a brilliant time it is to be a consumer these days, because you can find so many different devices that will work with pretty much whatever your workflow is going to be.
And of course, Huawei's benefiting a lot from Apple and the iPad Pro. I mean, there's a lot of iPad in this. In fact, the keyboard, the way the keyboard works, very much like the
arguably the camera case. Is in a better position than on the iPad Pro.
Yeah, I'd say that.
I'd say that. Let's say they stole that from Samsung.
Where's the camera on the? You mean the back camera?
On the side? No, the front camera on the iPad is
the
chat portrait.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, they did it. They did it on the top of the long side.
The original iPad keyboard was portrait too. Yeah. You'd stick the whole thing standing up.
That's definitely a guess. That's definitely a war that's been fought and lost. The idea of actually doing productive things in portrait mode.
Yeah.
People want things that are sideways.
Yeah.
following the guideways of middle management and upper management in corporate America since time immemorial.
This has a little docking station with USB, Ethernet, HDMI. Yeah. The pen is 2048. They do. I love the Nexus 6P.
Build quality is right up there.
This is... This basically the Surface Pro pricing. I mean, it starts at $600 and that's without a keyboard or pen. So, you're going to be spending $1,000 pretty easy out of the gate.
It seems like the sweet spot for this kind of device, though. I mean, everything is falling in similar lines with that.
They're doing the same thing as Apple's doing with the rechargeable battery in the pen, too, which is kind of interesting. Although they don't have it stick out.
It's so funny. I mean, Apple gets so much flack for that design decision, but when you talk to anybody about it, it's like
it's very convenient.
You are sitting at the coffee shop and your pen runs out and you don't have a cable. You just plug it in and 15 seconds super later, convenient. You're back at work.
Yeah.
So like the design decision there is super clear. Like it may look odd, but like when you're in the coffee shop, I've done that a bunch of times and I'm super happy that it's that way.
Yeah.
Okay. This one has a laser pointer too.
Oh yeah, the pen has a laser pointer built into it. And you can use it to advance your PowerPoint slides.
I'm often here to play devil's advocate as well because I'm just as enthusiastic about stuff as Renee is. And when Renee speaks first, he'll say the stuff that I like about something, which only leads me to just point out that, yeah, but you know, on my styluses for other devices, the battery lasts more than a couple of weeks, so I don't have to do that.
It's true. The pencil does not last very long.
No. Yeah, and also I really have to like almost you know how like the key on a gas station bathroom has to be attached to like a tire rim to make sure that no one walks off with it. I've kind of got the same thing going on with the recharger coupler for my pencil because I know that if I want to get like that full deep fast charge on it, you need to put that on the end of it. And it's just so it's like a tic tac, and it's the easiest thing in the world for me to lose.
I just have a dedicated cable for that now. It doesn't leave that one cable. And I hope
just
I don't
buy another
it.
Pencil.
Yeah. I have day and night pencils, Andy.
Get one for the boat, for the RV, for the car.
If Alex was here, you'd say you could shrink wrap it onto there.
We had a case on iOS today yesterday. Megan has a leather case that has a loop on it. It's really quite nice. Who makes that case, Megan? She's not there. She's not there. Talking to nobody. Error 53 is fixed. Apple said, yeah, we blew it. It was a mistake. We didn't want it to be brick your phone. That was kind of a factory message. That's kind of my guess as well. That does not seem Apple-ish. In fact, the good news, if you had a bricked phone, you just connect it up to iTunes and the new 9.2.1 patch will revive it.
Yeah, that's the important thing. It's not presented to you and it's not flagged as new. You have to specifically go and get it. Yeah.
You will lose fingerprint functionality until you...
You won't lose it, but you won't get it back. So,
okay, you never had it.
Yes.
It's true. There's very little fingerprint functionality on a brick.
It turns out that this was an error meant for factory so that if the components didn't properly pair, they would get this error and they would fix it. And it wasn't meant to be shown to consumers, but stuff happened.
Right.
So.
That makes a lot of sense. We are now only 3 weeks away from another Apple event at which we expect an iPad Air 3, an iPhone, what are they going to call it? The 5SE? Anything more that we know about that? Or any more rumors? Watch bands too.
Yeah, some more watch bands.
But will they have an octagonal watch? I don't know.
I'm shaking my magic 8-ball. Signs point to no.
I'm kind of actually liking this. It does notifications, which is kind of like a Pebble in that respect. You know, I can play my audio book.
They have a lot of really smart people at Fitbit. They make a great product, and they've got a good presence in the market.
Yeah.
And you're talking about point of view here. This is a watch that is built specifically to be a fitness device, and all the apps and all the notifications, those are nice, but the engineers are focusing on making it a great fitness device.
And I can choose the exercise I'm going to do.
And there's no Apple Watch equivalent of the iPod Shuffle or the iPod Nano, and Fitbit makes a variety of devices at a variety of price points for you to get into the market with.
Right. view on, brightness auto, heart rate auto. Let's see, ABC TV, Apple TV 4 adds Disney Channel, Disney XD, watch ABC to Universal Search. And of course, you mentioned Siri.
Yep.
Police rescue a teenage girl. Mother locates not only the phone, but the girl using Find My iPhone. Nice, so happy ending. And then dual cameras. We talked a little bit about the fact that the rumor is that the new iPhone 7 in the fall will have two camera sensors on the back. LG announced the G5 at Mobile World Congress. That has two sensors, but no, I don't think they're going to do the same thing Apple, or I don't think Apple's going to do the same thing LG's doing. One of the sensors is a normal sensor, and then the other sensor is a ultra wide angle, 135 millimeter.
It looks great, though.
It's a neat yeah. idea.
Yeah.
I had a Kodak made a camera just like that, where there was a zoom, and then if you went past a certain point of the zoom, it would switch to a totally separate lens and sensor. And you do not know how much you appreciate having just a little bit extra wide view until you realize that I don't have to step back. I don't have to lean back over this railing. I could just simply take a picture and get everybody in the shot.
And
even in our business for interviews, you want two people in an interview, and how much difference a wide angle makes.
If you need to get closer, you can always zoom. You can always crop the photo closer, but you can't put the left half of that face back into the frame.
If you love the album, I Like It When You Sleep For You Are So Beautiful Yet So Unaware of It. Long title.
Apparently, do I?
Do you? I do. That's from the 1975, which is a very well-named band. I don't know their music, but they're going to be performing on Beats 1 live at the perfect time for a concert, 9 a.m. Pacific. So I'll be asleep, and I'm so unaware of it during the concert.
Worldwide, Leo. Breaking. Worldwide.
Yeah, 9 a.m. is just Pacific time. So that's interesting. This will be the first, I think it's the first live concert on Beats 1. Is that right?
Yeah, they're ramping up.
Yeah.
It behooves them to get as much original content onto Apple Music as possible, because that's how you convert people to subscribers.
Well, and that's the point. Beats 1 is still available to people who don't subscribe. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be an Apple Music user to be an Apple Music lover.
Nice.
Lover.
Did you just put back in your 1970s DJ voice?
You don't have to. Yeah, baby. I like it when you're asleep because you're
that
so
that was 1 a.m.
Oh, my.
Oh, my. Time to move on to phase three of your date if you're not there already. Help you out.
I call that the Wednesday afternoon format. It's 5:33 on a Wednesday afternoon. A beautiful afternoon out there. Hope you're having a good time. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Can't Heat and Going Down Country. Our show today brought to you by Texture, the mobile app that gives you all the world's best magazines right there in your tablet or your phone. And it's like cool. It's kind of like Netflix for magazines. Texture.com/MacBreak to try it free. Everybody binge watches movies on Netflix. Well, now you can binge read magazines on Texture. I love it. And by the way, what's great, because you have all these magazines on here, is you can, of course, read a magazine to cover, but you also can cover a subject cover to cover. And the Texture editors have made that possible by having curated topics that you will dip into a variety of magazines. From Forbes, People, Newsweek, Wired, Popular Science. There are lots of magazines in here. Who wants to buy a magazine just because you want to read that cover story on Vanity Fair? I don't want to buy the magazine. I don't even want to subscribe to it. Macworld's in there. So's the National Geographic. So's PC Magazine. Popular Photography. PC World. Sound and Vision. That's a great stereo magazine. Love that. I like just drooling over the stuff at Sound and Vision. But you don't have to subscribe to Sound and Vision. You can subscribe to one site, texture.com/MacBreak, and get them all. Even dip into the gossip a little bit. You know, you want a break. You got a little time. Find out what's going on with Gwen and Blake and People Magazine or Us Weekly, Entertainment Weekly. Esquire. There's another magazine where there's one article every month I want to read. But how are you going to get it? Look, there's an article about the new host of The Daily Show, Trevor Noah. I love him. I'd love to know more about him and his big bat. And now you can.
So you're South African.
That's right. Another South African. I got to learn that accent. Will you give me lessons? Texture.com/MacBreak. Try it free right now. You'll get immediate entry to all the top magazines. By the way, it's the full magazine. It's everything in that magazine on the newsstand today, but also back issues and bonus material you can't get in print, like videos. Love it. Love it. Never lack for something great to read today. Oh, there's Jenny and some guy. Texture.com/MacBreak. Try it free. We thank them so much for their support of MacBreak Weekly. Andy has gotten up to retrieve, I think, his pick of the week. What do you got there for us?
I was actually using it this morning. This is, keep listening because you're gonna be bored.
Oh, dear.
This is a Bluetooth speaker.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Never saw that before.
Exactly. This has two neat features, the reason why I bought it. Number one, that, of course, it is waterproof. It is the whatever the IPX rating is for splash proof. So it solves problem number one for me, which is that I had in my master bathroom like a big like wireless speakers so I have to plug them in so I can listen to some music and podcasts while I shower and perform my morning ablutions. This one I can actually like, I don't have to blast it to get over the sound of the shower because I can actually keep like dangle this over the shower head or in the shampoo rack.
Oh, but Andy, that's going to get wet.
Well, you rinse it off because it's splash proof.
Oh, how nice.
But there are a bunch of splash proof and shower quality Bluetooth speakers. I got it because you see it's round.
Yeah.
And also it is roughly like would you call that bottle shaped?
Yeah.
And so if you just bought a new bike.
Oh dear.
And you are not and you don't feel as though it is any way safe to even have one earphone in, you can actually put this in the bottle in any of your bottle racks. And you will have this beautiful hysterical speaker, and I'm listening. And it's beautiful, and it's also surprisingly loud. I didn't really realize that until I was riding home after like a date at a coffee shop, and it's like 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, and it's on like sort of a quiet street, like about 2 miles from my house. And it's like John Houdman is a political candidate, and I'm just like I'm like the announcement the campaign van, because you just hear John Houdman's voice reverberating off of every house and every street sign, which I didn't think it was that loud until I was like, okay, let's pull over, let's turn.
Oh,
that
your
down.
Neighbors did.
I feel as though they think I'm advertising something, but it does work great. I mean, I don't. I'm not the sort of person who, when I like take walks or exercise, think my mind is not occupied by, oh, isn't it wonderful? I'm in the fresh air and I'm being healthy. It's like I want to spend this half hour listening to something.
Distract me, yeah, quick.
Please let me do something. So, and it's not that expensive either. I got this for like $35, $40 on Amazon. It's made by Al Petronics. I'm sorry I didn't put it into the show notes, but I'll have it for you shortly. Alpatronix. And it's like $35 on Amazon. You also get has this beautiful like hanging loop, and you get a sack you can put it into, and pairs pretty easily. So I'm very happy with it.
Very nice. Very nice indeed. Thank you, Andrew. Renee Ritchie, what do you got for us?
I have two. The first one is a little bit self-serving. So we decided I wanted a T-shirt for Stand with Apple, and I couldn't find one. So we decided to make one. All the proceeds go to the EFF. So I put the link in the show notes, and it's up on iMore now. So if you go there. Yeah, we're only doing it for a few days because it seemed more topical than long term. So you can go there. You can order one. There's a bunch of different colors. There's men's and women's, and there's hoodies. We put it as low a cost as Teespring would allow, but any profit that might come in will go to the EFF. So it's not about making any money on this. It's just about giving people who want to, you know, make a statement the ability to make that statement if they choose. We chose non-infringing emoji for people who asked why we didn't use the Apple emoji.
Are the Apple emoji like copyrighted?
I didn't want to find out. I don't want to be a test case. So we've
just found out that Apple does have lots of lawyers, and they're willing to fight people a lot better pocketed.
Well, Apple's
than
latest shirts. If you go to the Infinite Loop Apple Store, their latest shirts are using the Apple emoji, and we didn't want to make it look like it came from Apple or anything like that. I wanted to be as upfront about it as possible. So
that's actually probably the best reason. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's only available. So if you're listening to this later, I apologize, and we'll do something in the future that's different than this. But it's available, I think, for the next 2 or 3 days.
Oh, dear.
So
rush.
Yeah, it's, It's already funded, so you have nothing to worry about. Just go there and grab it. For people who are listening later and for people who are interested in general, I had this experience recently, and we talked about it before, Leo's. Every year I do a security audit. I go through the watch list in 1Password. I reset everything. I change things. And I got a lot more into two-factor authentication. And I've been hesitant about that because I always did it right away so I could document it for the readers. And it was often not a good experience. Like, I got locked out of Dropbox for a long time because I just never got the second factor text, no matter how often I tried. So I didn't have a lot of it enabled, but I went through and systematically started enabling it. But then I got a second problem. I started traveling so much, going to Winnipeg or going to San Francisco, I would be up in the air and all of a sudden, Canada got Wi-Fi on their planes. Who knew? And I could start doing all these things. But the browser would detect a state change and demand that I re-authenticate. And I'm on an airplane where I can't get text messages. So I couldn't get into Google. I couldn't get into Twitter. I couldn't get into a lot of things. And I was using devices I had just picked up at the place that I'd been to. So I didn't really set up everything as well as I should. So I started using Authy. And Authy is really cool. It's one of those things where it's basically time sync. So it's always providing you with a code that's the code that the app expects. So for example, if I want to log into, I use it for the VPN that I connect to for work a lot, almost all the time, because that requires a second factor. I use it for Slack. I use it for a bunch of other applications. And the nice thing is I don't have to wait for a text message. The number appears right on my phone, or even better, on my Apple Watch. And then I can just put it right in. And because the Apple Watch is kind of a second screen for the iPhone for me, when I'm using it on iPhone, I don't have to flip back and forth and try and remember the number. I just show it on my Apple Watch, type it in on my iPhone, and I'm ready to go. And it's so far been way better than getting a text message, which has proven still kind of unreliable, even, you know, in 2016. So I just have a ton of stuff stored in there now. You can ask Siri to launch it for you, but Siri doesn't seem to actually understand the word Authy, so you have to use the old all caps A-U-T-H thing to get it to launch. But it's just about as simple and as fast as I'd want it to be. And I know some password managers, including the one I use, build this in, but I like the idea of an app that I use it so often, I just double-click the crown on my watch and I'm there and I'm getting it and I'm putting it in. And I'm being asked for it so often now for so many apps that it's made what could be cumbersome in that continual war between security and convenience almost tenable. Like, I almost don't even think about it anymore. And that to me is a huge security win.
Very nice.
Yeah, I've been using Authy for a long time. Really great one-step solution for everything.
It's funny. All three of us have independently moved to Authy instead of Google Authenticator. And anything you do with Authenticator, you can use with Authy. Yep. But it's just, I love it that I don't have to enter in. You know what I was doing? So I was saving the QR codes in my LastPass.
Yes.
Because that way then I could set up a new device. I could point it at the QR code. But Authy just solves that whole thing. It's really
and
nice.
It will let you sync. Like, if you choose to, it'll let you sync across devices. So I was always worried that if I lost that device, that was it for me. But I have it on enough devices now that I'm fairly confident I'll always have one of them available.
Yeah, yeah. I use it as a Google plugin, a Chrome plugin. So mm-hmm. that means it's everything. You know, as soon as I set up Chrome, I got Authy.
So great.
Yeah, there's a time where I had to wait. I actually had to wait like an hour and a half to set up a new phone or something, because the last thing that I'd authorized for the Google password was my Nexus 5, which was I hadn't used in 2 weeks, and now it was completely flat and dead, and was the old style of Android, so that I had to wait a long time for it to get enough juice to actually log in.
Right.
It was
And as you mentioned, it's Apple Watch compatible, but I love it that I could pull in. I turn the Authy notifications on my iPhone, because then I can just pull down my notifications and I've got my Authys. My Authys are all there, baby. Very nice, yeah. My pick is something that I discovered independently, and I hope you guys don't hate it, because I haven't really asked around. But I like the idea. So one of our viewers, and I mentioned it yesterday on iOS Today, one of our viewers emailed us, Frank Petronas, and he said, my wife and I want some way to back up all our photos from our phones. So that we can, you know, we back them up and we have access to them. And I mentioned Google, of course, Google Photos. And if you're at all Mac, then or all Apple, rather, then you certainly can use iCloud Photo Drive. But this is something that's a little different and maybe could be used in conjunction with Photos or iCloud. It's called Live from Seagate, LYVE. And I'm sure they see this just as a way to sell more hard drives. In fact, if you use a Seagate disk attached storage drive, I just bought a 4 terabyte drive for $110, and you run the Live software, it will see it and say, well, you'd like me to use this to back up your photos. But I bought this little thing that Live makes that's a standalone drive. Let me see if I can find the drive here. And it's about the size of an iPhone. It has an iPhone-sized screen on it. Now, they say $300. I'm not sure I'd recommend this at $300, but right now on Amazon, it's $150 for 2 terabytes of storage. That's a pretty good price, plus the screen. You can put it on Wi-Fi or Ethernet. And then if you have the Live software on your iPhone, your iPad, your Mac, your Windows, your Android, which I do, it'll automatically back it up. You can even set it up. I'm just setting it up here on this Mac to automatically back up photos. And these are backing up originals, by the way, not reduced size photos from photos and photo booth. But you can also have watch folders so that if there's a folder like your Lightroom folder you always upload images to, it'll sync those as well. So within a couple of days, I had all 30,000 of my photos on my Live drive in the house. And when I come in the house, or when actually it does it over the internet too. So when I take new photos, they're always backed up there. It has an HDMI port in the back, so you can connect it to a screen, big screen TV if you want, and have a slideshow. You know, I really like this. And at $150 and the software is free, I think this is a good solution if you want your own backup in addition to any cloud solution.
Yeah.
The only negative is it doesn't do RAW files yet, although the Seagate folks say they're working on that. But it does do JPEGs and other standard file formats. Yeah. You're familiar with this, Andy?
Haven't heard of it, but you cannot have too many automatic backups of your
yep.
photos.
Yep.
I pay for unlimited storage on Google. Even though my pictures folders and libraries are automatically backed up to my network server, and there are all kinds of other backup systems built in, because it's not just having one solution. It's what if 5 years from now you want to get a hold of a picture, right, and maybe you lost a certain hard drive or you stopped using a certain backup service, you'll realize, oh, that's right, I was having everything automatically backed up to Google or automatically backed up to iCloud, or, oh, that's right, I had that cool device on, right? And even if you stop using it, if you put it in your closet, you'll plug it back in again, and now you'll get all your pictures back.
And the other thing is that your pictures are now available in all the devices with the Live software. So I can, I could see 30,000 pictures on my iPhone, on my iPad. Of course, it doesn't download them all, but you can download any individual picture. And that's kind of nice, too.
Yeah.
And it has an SD card slot in the hardware, so you can take your camera thing and just plug it in and get it backed up immediately. It has a USB slot. You could connect a hard drive to it and back that up. Pretty sweet. I think for $150, I don't know about that's, 300, but for $150, that's a pretty good thing. And remember, that screen is small. It's an iPhone-sized screen. It's not huge.
Yeah.
It's a good little, you know what? You could put it somewhere like on your desk and it becomes a photo frame and a clock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And because it's Wi-Fi, you don't have to have it Ethernet, although I have it Ethernet connected.
Yeah. Sometimes you sense that the one of the most important decisions in a design was what's the most amount of money that we can price this at and still have a good product that people will like.
Right.
Because you're right. It's like can't remember that. What was that that actual upholstered nightstand computer?
Oh, yeah. I want to say Quimby or Bushy or
something like that. It was really cool. It was really interesting, but it was way too expensive for just someone to buy a cool and interesting thing. But $150. It sounds like this is about how this gets my attention and gets my interest.
Well, and you can even save money because, as I said, if you don't care about the screen, you can buy a 4 terabyte Seagate DAS. Yeah. It has to be a DAS drive. I bought it for $110. Connect that to your Mac. Of course, your Mac has to be on for it to back up. But now that will work with Live. That becomes a Live drive in exactly the same way. So you get to choose. In fact, you could have one at home and one at work if you really want to go crazy. Chumby.
That's it.
Thank you, Virgil. Chumby.
I still have the bag that it came in, that because my sous vide device, the Innova, fits in that perfectly with its accessories. I don't know where the actual device is, though.
Chumby. All right, that does it for this edition of Mac Break Weekly. A good show today once again. I don't know how we do it day week in, week out, but that's one of the best things about having Andy Iannocco and Renee Ritchie on the team. You know it's going to be a great conversation. Andy, of course, writes for the Chicago Sun-Times. Look for his piece on the Stand with Apple case any minute now. They were smart to defer because it's evolved a lot since Wednesday.
It's, again, it's I have so much respect for people in Renee's position where the value that they provide is to make sure that when you hear about something, you go to iMore and they'll have something about it.
Right.
I'm just pleased that I get to be more editorial in what I do.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's I'm happy with the stuff that the thing that I drafted yesterday than the thing that was ready to go last week.
Yep. Renee Ritchie, iMore.com. And of course, there's another great place to go if it, whether it's story like this and you want to get a t-shirt or you want to find out what's the deal with the pencil no longer supporting UI controls. And you get Serenity's column. It's a really, iMore is really a must have.
And we added Lori Gill and Daniel Bader this week.
Oh, nice.
Last week, sorry. Yeah, Lori Gill, awesome app and how-to writer. And Daniel Bader used to be editor-in-chief of Mobile Syrup. So really good team.
You guys are growing fast. Trying. And by the way, your partner site has done a great job at Mobile World Congress.
Oh, they're awesome.
What is it? Android?
Android Central.
Central, that's it. I don't want to say the wrong one. Android Central.
I'm not a partner site anymore. I'm sort of responsible for a lot of the stuff on all of them now. Oh, so good. I can't pick from the kids anymore.
You didn't take this opportunity for a junket to Barcelona?
No, actually, Derek Kessler, our managing editor.
He got the junket, huh?
He got the Jamal, the Jamal Iberica.
The Hamon.
I've gone to Mobile World Congress just for the ham.
Yeah.
Stay
for the ham
sets. If
you've
never been to Barcelona, you have no idea. It's like Coca-Cola is over here. That's what every, it's like. There's
good.
A gas station and there's ham. Not just like pre. Yes. I'm saying there's a hawk right there with the cash register and a guy with a knife who will like peel you up. Oh.
Barcelona, where men are men and pigs are afraid.
Oh, pigs are pleased. If a pig's nose is going to die anyway,
at least it's going to be jamon.
At least don't. At least it's not going to wind up in like a Taco Bell burrito or a hot dog. He's going to be treated with greatest respect.
If you could be carnitas or jamon ibérico, be jamon ibérico.
I am so hungry right now.
I love it. By the way, I ordered a Galaxy S7. The Edge. Oh, that God. Thing's going to be. A stunner.
LG too, Leo? Or are you waiting on
I'll
that
get
one?
The LG. I don't know if when it's available. Is it available for order now?
I don't think so. No.
But I'll be getting the G7, I think, before in like less than 2 weeks.
Regular or Edge?
Of course Edge.
Nice.
I have the S6 Edge, and I really liked it. It didn't have enough battery life, and it didn't have enough RAM. It was a little there was some hesitation.
Yeah,
they've solved that. The SD cards, I think it's going to be a very tough competitor to the iPhone.
Isn't it exciting that every time we look at a new phone, we are looking at a brand new, like it's a camera with phone features on it.
Oh man, and F1.7.
Yeah,
the leap in quality. Yeah, exactly. I bought a Nexus specifically because I want to get updates directly from Google, and I don't want to have the extra Samsung cruft. But that camera, man alive.
Mm. Yeah, and they went down. I mean, I'm glad that. Companies aren't hesitating to go down in pixels if it means megapixels if it means enhancements and everything else.
Yeah, it's 12 instead of 16. Yeah. I think taking a leaf from That's Apple's fine. Book, they're also doing something Apple kind of pioneered. Actually, maybe Canon pioneered it—the idea of using the pixels themselves for phase detection focusing.
Yeah,
but unlike Apple, they're going to use every one of those 12 megapixels for phase detection focusing. We'll see. That looked pretty impressive in the demo, but those demos are faked. So,
but
you know, I have to try some fast focusing.
I'm confident you guys will put it to the test.
I think the low light's going to be good. I'm and I really like the S6 camera, right, Andy? Wasn't that a great camera?
Yeah. Samsung keeps raising the bar every single time. I think that's one of the reasons why Apple did not have the option of not doing a 12 megapixel camera, because leaving last year's phone was kind of kicking the iPhone's butt. It was delivering pictures that were as good quality, but also with higher resolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I want these people to just hate each other's guts so badly. I want them to be mortally offended. I want there to be this meeting inside of Apple, not embarrassing. Screw those guys. If they think they have a better, God dang it. You know what? I'm calling my husband right now and saying that we're
pulling an all-nighter.
Exactly. You're going to be raising the kids for the next 6 months because I will be damned if we let Samsung have a better camera than we have.
By the way, as you probably saw if you tuned in early, I got the new octagonal watch from Fitbit, the Fitbit Blaze, and I just got it, so I won't have a review for you until next week, but I will talk about it next week on the show. It looks pretty sweet. I'm already liking it a little bit. We'll see. Yeah. If the heart rate monitor can be as accurate as the Apple Watch, I might be going all outside of Apple.
I'm so glad that you're in front of a microphone when you unboxed this, because your attitude about this watch over the past 2.5 hours, watching it change from, oh gee, I can see that, to, well, actually, you know, I kind of like it now.
Yeah, I don't mind. The octagonal shape. It doesn't look bad on my wrist.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm a big boy.
Wrist totally, sir. It's totally, you know, good for this.
I'm a big boy.
Just not for dames, perhaps, but
not for the ladies. But you know, it's great. It's already getting notifications from the iPhone. It's already it does it's like a Pebble. It does a lot of the same kind of pebbly things. All right, everybody, that's it. Go back to work, because break time is over.